Swing into Seaside Golf in Ocean City, Maryland. Play like a pro at 17 championship courses designed by golf legends like Jack Nicklaus and Arthur Hills. Tee off on sweeping vistas at Eagle's Landing. Savor the coastal views of Lighthouse Sound. Or see why Ocean City Golf Club is considered one of the Mid-Atlantic's finest fairways. Whether you're sneaking in a quick round on a family vacation or going all in on a golf getaway, fun is always in play at Ocean City, Maryland. Plan your trip at OCOcean.com.
Hi, this is Podside the UK.
I'm Coco Khan.
And I'm Nish Kumar.
And on today's show, it's been the best of years and the worst of years for our guest, Scotland's First Minister, Humza Yousaf.
He got his dream job as Scottish First Minister.
But was he given the mother of all hospital passes by Nicola Sturgeon?
After 17 years in power, the once dominant SNP has suffered a decline in the polls, and there is an ongoing police investigation into its finances.
We'll ask First Minister Humza Yousaf if he can turn things around in 2024. Nish, how are you?
Very good, Coco. How are you?
Sometimes when we do the intro credits and we go, hi, it's me, Coco Khan, and it's you, I always have this temptation to say, hi, it's me, Nish Kumar. Do you have that?
Can I tell you something? My friend, Brett Goldstein, star of stage and screen, there's two things to tell you about. He listens to this show and he calls that section the bit where Nish reads his own name. He says it makes him laugh so much that it sounds like I'm reading my own name in the opening credits because I don't know my own name. He also, and this is a slightly more convoluted inside joke, I used to do a show on a much missed short form content platform called Quibi, which existed, I think, for about 5 minutes, which ironically was the length of most of his content. And he used to watch that show on the toilet.
Oh.
So he referred to the show as Toilet Nish. He said it was the perfect length of time for him to take a dump and find out what was going on in the news. And now he calls this podcast Toilet Nish the podcast.
Toilet Nish the podcast. I think that is a touch rude.
I don't know whether because of the podcast length, he's now taking 45 minute dumps, but he needs to
see a doctor. It's what he needs.
he refers to this as Toilet Nish, the podcast.
I don't really know how I'm meant to take that. I don't really know how to receive it. I had this thing the other day where I was walking down the street and this guy comes up to me as a listener and was like, excuse me, I hope this isn't too weird. Do you do a podcast? And I was like, yeah, I do a podcast. And he was like, do you host the podcast? And I said, yes, I do. And then he was about to say, are you? And I was so close to being like, that's right, it's me, Nish Kumar. I really, really, really want, and it took everything to hold me back. You don't ever get that.
What, people coming up to me and saying, are you Coco Khan?
Just like the desire to mix up the, you don't have that?
No, people are very nice about the podcast. Right. They often come up and say that they really enjoy it. And they often tell me that they are surprised that you're funnier than me, which I'm not because I know you.
We're getting a lot of negs, aren't we? This Toilet Nish podcast.
Everyone's flirting with us, Coco.
Is it?
Everyone's negging us. The whole world is trying to bang us.
This is the game.
Everyone's trying to bang us. It's hard being this pretty. Our guest this week is Scotland's First Minister and leader of the Scottish National Party, Humza Yousaf. First Minister, hello and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, what a pleasure.
It's quite an odd one, I think, in some ways for us to be having a conversation because we are a show that's called Pod Save the UK and we're interviewing someone whose entire political life has been dedicated to leaving the UK.
And will continue to be. That is interesting. But actually, a lot of commonality across the UK, I'm sure we'll touch upon that as well. So, no, I'm glad to
and
be
also,
on,
you but, and I have something else in common in that we're the same fucking age, which obviously makes me feel a lot of things about my life and the decisions I've taken.
Oh, that's not true. I've never sold out the Apollo, but then neither of you. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. No. Look, the thing is, your career is on, of course, the upward trajectory. I've hit the pinnacle and the peak. And, you know.
Are your parents still saying, sure, you're leading the country, but where was that medical career?
Yeah. Well, actually, my mum gave me a bit of trouble recently because it was at the family house having dinner. I've got two sisters and they were over with their husbands. I'm having a chat, and just because I was talking to my sister, not for any other reason, the rest of them were cleaning up, and I was going to get up and clean up, Mum. But she said, and she said this in Punjabi, but she said, you know, you're First Minister, don't think you can't do the dishes and make me get up. I was like, it's nothing to do with First Minister. I was literally talking to my sister about it. Anyway, so my mum keeps me grounded, I think.
That's important. That's important. We had a funny conversation before you came on air. We were like, oh, what should we call him? Obviously, we've got this Desi moment, so presumably we can be informal. And I think you had a great suggestion, didn't you, Nish?
What?
First Minister Bai.
First Minister Bai.
I like that. First Minister Bai. I like that. That's good. That's good. Let's go with that. First Minister Bai. I mean, I thought you were about to hit me out with some real Punjabi swear words a moment ago. But let's keep that for the after.
We'll keep that. So we've got a lot we want to talk to you about. But before we get into it, we just wanted to take a moment to reflect on the story that's kind of overshadowed everything else this week. And that is the announcement that King Charles is being treated for cancer. Prince Harry flew in from California to spend some time with his father at Clarence House yesterday. The King and Queen Camilla have now gone to their Sandringham estate in Norfolk, where they're expected to stay while he undergoes treatment. In an interview with BBC Radio 5 Live, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak seemed to break protocol by revealing more than was in Buckingham Palace's statement.
Well, obviously, like everyone else, you're shocked and sad, and just all our thoughts are with him and his family. And, you know, thankfully, this has been caught early, and now everyone will be wishing him that he gets the treatment that he needs and makes a full recovery. I think that's what we're all hoping and praying for. And I'm, of course, in regular contact with him, and we'll continue to communicate with him as normal.
Were you told the news before it was made public?
I was, as it tends to be protocol, but obviously we didn't say anything publicly until the news broke publicly. And look, my sentiments are similar to everybody else's. You know, there'll not be a person in the country that probably hasn't been impacted or affected by cancer in some way, shape or form. And actually, in one sense, it doesn't matter if you're king or not. You're going to have children that are worried about you, your partner, your wife that's worried about you. And many others, given it is the king, right across the country, that are worried for himself. So speedy recovery to him, and I hope he gets back into his public engagements. And, you know, in fairness to the king, and look, my views are well known around monarchy, and I describe myself very much as a Republican. But I absolutely think he has been ahead of his time on many issues, climate change being one of them. So look, I think his voice is an important one. As I say, I just wish him all the very best of health.
We're coming up to quite an important anniversary for you personally, because it's almost a year since your predecessor, Nicola Sturgeon, announced her resignation, which just felt quite shocking at the time. It obviously changed your life massively and led to you taking over as leader of the SNP and First Minister. What was that moment like?
You're right, it was a shock. I remember the day very, very well. So Nicola resigned publicly on the 15th, made her announcement. But she phoned me the day before Valentine's Day, actually on the 14th. And a bit strange getting a phone call from your boss on Valentine's Day. And you kind of go, I wonder what's up here. And it was late at night. I think it was about 9:45, I think, when she gave me a call.
So you really had no sense that was coming? That completely came out of the blue to you?
Oh, completely. And the timing of it, I think most of us probably thought Nicola's likely to resign ahead of 2026. That's when the next Scottish elections are due to take place. But many of us thought it would be probably years down the line. So completely out of the blue, in complete shock. And I mean, the first sentence she said to me, I knew what she was going to tell me. She said, I said, how are you? She said, I'm okay, but you're not going to like what I've got to say to you. And I said, well, don't say it. And she then decided to say it and tell me. And it was a bit of profanity from my end. And then I said something like at the end of the conversation, which is almost grassing her up. I said to her, right, I'm going to go speak to John about this because it's outrageous, I think, that you're resigning. And John John Swinney was her deputy. And I phoned him and he said, look, I've had the conversation with her. Her mind's made up, Hamza. This is just a new phase and era that we've got to... And then he said, you should go for it. Kind of urged me to think about it and consider it. And it's a bizarre thing, by the way. I mean, she resigned, you know, and it was the Wednesday, and you've basically got till the Friday, 2 days, to make this life-changing decision. Because if you're going to launch campaign, you've got to do it early, you know, you've got to go, you want to be first, get that first kind of mover advantage, and yeah, you've got 2 days to basically put yourself in a bit of a bunker and talk to my wife primarily, also other members of my family, and come to a decision, what could be a life-altering decision that you make. And in my case, it absolutely was.
Do you think you felt prepared at that time for the challenges you were going to face?
So nothing can prepare you for being leader of your country. I've held various ministerial jobs. I've been in government for 11 and a half odd years. And I've had some really difficult, challenging roles. I'm a health secretary in the middle of a pandemic. But nothing can quite prepare you for the everyday challenges, strains, stress, doesn't matter what you do in advance of being first minister. Nothing can prepare you of being leader of your government and your country, but it's one hell of an honour.
I mean, I think sometimes those of us outside of politics assume that everyone who enters politics's eventual ambition is to be the leader of their party and then the leader of their country. But surely, I mean, and maybe it's just because we're the same age, but I have to believe that this has happened ahead of schedule for you. I think the last two things we can be young for are leader of a country or manager of a football club. Like, as far as I can tell, that's the last two things a 38-year-old can be young for.
I don't think it was really so much a kind of ambition that I thought about particularly proactively. It's kind of like being the captain of your football team, obviously.
Yeah.
Greater responsibility, I would suggest. But being the captain of your national team is something that you would absolutely be honoured to do, privileged to do. And yeah, if the opportunity ever came up, I think I had it in my head. You know, I've been in government for so many years. And ultimately, that was actually why I made the decision to go for it, was, well, I've done all of these different roles in government over the years. I've got this experience. If not now, then when? And there's an opportunity. What's the worst that can happen? The worst is that you go for it and you don't get it, and fair play to the person that does, and you get on with the job. Or you get it and you have the greatest honour of your life, which is leading the country you love, the country you call home, the country you're raising your kids in. What can be better than that?
The New York Times calls BritBox the best of British telly. Stream acclaimed original series, including Payback, starring Peter Mullen, Stonehouse, starring Matthew McFadyen, and Archie, the man who became Cary Grant, starring Jason Isaacs. Plus, discover powerful new series like Three Little Birds and the return of BAFTA-winning drama Time, starring Bella Ramsey, Tamara Lawrence, and Jodie Whittaker. Stream the best of British TV only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Well, Hamza, we are three people of colour, three South Asians, so let's fulfil every stereotype and talk about race.
I thought you were about to say bring out the samosas, but no.
Well, I was thinking earlier, because we're sort of sat in a little triangle, which has a samosa energy, doesn't it? It's quite
samosa
nice.
Samosa energy, yes.
It's going to be spicy in the middle, that's what we know for sure. We occasionally, me and Nish, like to style ourselves as the news Asians.
No one else does. I cannot stress that enough.
We're trying literally really no hard. One else does. And listen, you know, it's fascinating to see so many second-generation British Asians rising to the top of politics. You know, you've got yourself, Rishi Sunak as PM, recent cabinet ministers like Priti Patel, Sajid Javid, Sadiq Khan, London Mayor, you know, your opposite number, Anas Sarwar, is leading Scottish Labour. What do you think? Is this a sign of the success of multiculturalism?
Absolutely. And that's why I can't get over these politicians, usually conservative politicians who themselves are ministers in the government, saying that multiculturalism has failed. You're like, really? I mean, the evidence all around us is that actually people of colour have managed to progress, not just in political fields, but in business and the public sector. Now, by the way, there's a long way to go. I think about in Scotland, if I look across the public and the private sector, there's still too few people of colour at very senior roles. And there's a responsibility for me to try to do what I can to rectify that. But this idea that multiculturalism has failed, well, actually the evidence all around us tells us a very different story indeed. And I have to say, for all the differences I've got with the likes of Rishi Sunak, and those differences are many, look, I still celebrated the fact that a person of colour made it to number 10. I mean, that's good for other people of colour to look up to and say, well, actually, that office is attainable for me.
Can I ask you one question about one name that has not been mentioned? And that is Suella Braverman. And I think in terms of people who have said that multiculturalism has failed, she's actually one of them. It's so fucking weird. Like, it's so strange to see someone who has a similar ethnic background and I presume some similar overlaps in upbringing stand there and reject so many of the things that we have benefited from. How do you reckon with a political figure like Suella Braverman?
I think it's the very definition or personification of somebody pulling up the ladder after they've made it to the top. And actually, my view has always been that you should reach your hand out, try to bring others up with you. That's my responsibility to do. I don't want to be the last person of colour in this role by any stretch. And you've mentioned there, for example, South Asians that have done well. Well, actually, we want to see people that are Afro-Caribbean Scots. We want to see Chinese Scots. We want to see Jewish Scots. We want to see others that are minorities make their way to the highest levels of political office. And I think what worries me about the political rhetoric from the likes of Suella Braverman and others, and we saw it today with the Prime Minister, is really debasing and degrading our politics by getting into these real culture war issues as a complete distraction from the actual issues of substance. So whether it's trans rights, whether it's, of course, multiculturalism, whether it's issues around migration and immigration, where all the evidence tells you that things like holistic migration, evidence tells you almost virtually every study under the sun that migrants give more than they take. And yet we can't seem in this country to be capable of having a sensible conversation that says, well, we have this much, this many work vacancies and job vacancies. We need to grow our economy. Migrants give more than they take. Let's have a sensible approach to migration that helps our economic growth, helps our society and our culture as well. And we're just incapable of it because of this debasing and denigration of politics, which I'm afraid the Conservatives are the cheerleaders of. And I suppose the last thing I'd say is what my worry is, because the Tories are out the door, right? They're booted out. There's no ifs, buts. Maybe they're done. Thank goodness for it. My worry is that you've got a Labour Party who, at times, and I take the migration debate as an example, begin to fall into that same trap of following that dog whistle that the Conservatives seem to blow.
Mm, my concern with this set, and we'll just speak specifically about Rishi Sunak now, is that he is someone who, I mean, he recently gave an interview where he talked about how he had never experienced racism, really. You know, he had a sibling, I think, that was once called the P word. And he reflected in this piece being like, oh, you know, I'm glad that won't happen to my kids. And you just think you live on another planet, mate. Is that true?
Totally other planet.
I guess, actually, let me ask you, have you experienced racism on your way up to the top?
I mean, I think I probably experience a combination of racism and Islamophobia, if not every day, probably every week. I mean, I protect myself on social media now that I don't, you know, I don't look at notifications and so on and so forth. But there was a time when I did, and I'd be surprised if I wasn't the victim of racism, Islamophobia online constantly. But look, I've, you know, even had people charged a few months ago and found guilty of racism towards me. And, you know, do I think my children are immune from it? Not at all. Not at all. In fact, my worry is that they'll face it to a greater degree than I faced it growing up. And I say that because of exactly the points we're making. There's this, for some reason, obsession by some politicians, particularly those on the right, to open up division, to create division. Mm. And it's a very deliberate political tactic, whereas actually our responsibility as politicians who are only ever in leadership positions for a set period, right, where as all those who believe in democracy, we've got a responsibility to try to unify people and bring them together. That doesn't mean we don't have disagreements. We should have pretty robust exchanges around those disagreements. But we shouldn't be looking for these culture war issues to divide society. And my fear is for my girls growing up, one is four, one is 14, my worry is that they'll face and encounter more racism and Islamophobia than I ever did.
Have you encountered racism at Holyrood?
I don't think in necessarily the chamber. You know, I've had what we might call institutional racism or Islamophobia. And I was in a meeting a number of years ago now, I remember, with somebody who was from England and he lived in Scotland now. And I remember him at the beginning of the meeting saying, oh, you know, I'm from England. I'm an immigrant like you. Immigrant, mate. I mean, I went from Glasgow to Dundee. I mean, that's a bit harsh. But genuinely, and I actually said to him in the meeting, I'm not an immigrant. And he went, no. And he was completely flustered But I didn't mean it in any way malicious, but it was that almost institutional racism that, of course, you guys will encounter day in and day out. So probably institutionally, yes. Overtly, I'm pleased to say no. But of course, again, Holyrood is an institution and the Scottish Government as an institution is not immune to structural institutional racism by any stretch of the imagination.
Given that, you know, we sort of came of age in the post 9/11 period, was there ever a point where you were being pressured to not talk about your faith or to maybe kind of keep elements of that, of your personality to yourself?
Oh, for sure. For sure. Even when I became First Minister, you know, I put out a picture I think it was the day I got sworn in or if not the day, the day after, where I was in Bute House, which is the official residence of the First Minister in Edinburgh. And it was Ramadan. So when I became First Minister, so I broke my fast and then prayed alongside my family. And I put a photo of me praying with my family, praying alongside me. And I did that very purposely because I wanted to be known that actually having a First Minister who's Muslim and my faith is important to me, actually that should be perfectly normal. Yeah. And we should see that as perfectly normal. But there's a number of people, actually including some from within the Muslim community, who said to me, maybe you should just, you know, step back from your identity. You know, maybe it's not going to, maybe people are going to turn against you. I said, well, people will judge me on my politics, what I do, what I deliver. You know, what we don't deliver, that will be what we get judged on. But if people are going to judge me on my faith, I'm not going to pretend to be something I'm not.
Well, let's talk about the political situation. Most obvious challenge that you faced in the past year has been the investigation that's ongoing into the SNP's finances. Obviously, we know that you can't talk about it because it'd be seen to be influencing an ongoing police investigation. But I just wanted to ask you, how much harder does that make your job? And do you think that this has affected the public's trust in the SNP going into a general election year?
Yeah, look, I'm not going to insult the intelligence of the people who listen to your podcast and pretend that it hasn't been difficult. Of course, it has been tricky. But I look at just today when we're talking, you know, the latest poll, Ipsos Mori poll that's come out, puts us well ahead of the opposition, I mean, 7 points ahead of the Labour Party. We're not complacent about that, and we're going to work hard, of course, every vote between now and a general election. But also that point about trust is really important. I think in every single area the poll asks about, we're trusted more than our nearest rival, the Labour Party. So we're trusted more than the Labour Party on the NHS, on the economy, and so on and so forth. And that to me tells me, yep, the police investigation and other external headwinds will be a challenge. But if we can deliver for people, then that's what matters to them. So if they're in their house and they see that their council tax is frozen and they've still got access to free childcare, they don't pay a penny for their child's tuition fees at some of the best universities in the world, and their child who's under 22 can travel free in the buses, yeah, I've got to focus on delivery. That's the name of the game.
Well, yeah, let's talk about Nicola Sturgeon now. She's been back in the public eye at the COVID inquiry. She was your mentor. You've spoken extensively about your personal affection for her and the high regard you hold her in as a politician. She got quite emotional at the COVID inquiry last week. Let's just hear a brief clip of that.
I was the First Minister when the pandemic struck. There's a large part of me wishes that I hadn't been, but I was, and I wanted to be the best First Minister I could be during that period. It's for others to judge the extent to which I succeeded.
Was it hard to watch her shed a tear at last week's COVID inquiry?
Very hard. Yeah. Very hard. Because, look, I worked alongside Nicola. I was her, initially during the pandemic, I was her Justice Secretary, and then I was her Health Secretary for a period throughout it. And she and I worked very closely together. And I can tell you without a single iota of doubt or hesitation that Nicola Sturgeon worked her socks off for one reason and one reason only, and that was to try to protect people in this country from harm of COVID. And I would look at Nicola some days and she would look utterly exhausted. I could see that she'd lost weight. I was talking to her and she wasn't sleeping. This was just constant, and she was nothing but dedicated to that. Now, did she get everything right? Did we get everything right? Of course not. And she'll be the first to absolutely admit that. And the whole purpose of the inquiry is to really probe into those issues. Could you have done lockdown earlier? Should you have tested those that were discharged from hospital sooner? These are all the right questions, absolutely, to be probing. But questioning, I think, Nicola's integrity To me, that's beyond doubt that she absolutely worked her socks off, and as I say, all for the reason and absolutely for the purpose of stopping the harm of COVID from spreading more than it was. So yeah, that was pretty hard to watch, if I'm honest.
Have you spoken to her since that? I mean, is she okay?
I did, very briefly, and you know, she found it difficult. But, you know, that was a private conversation, so I won't say too much more about it. But I spoke to her to see how she was, because Nicola is still my colleague. I've got a job to make sure my colleagues' well-being is okay. And a lot of them, they're really under a significant amount of scrutiny and even pressure. You know, I think our mental health, regardless of what role you're in, is really important. We just all look out for each other.
Well, on the subject of the well-being of politicians, we a question out to some of our listeners to ask, hey, what would you like to ask the First Minister? And actually, a lot of our listeners wanted to ask, are you okay? You know, obviously, we heard a lot about your family, your in-laws, particularly in Gaza. I mean, how is everything?
Look, it's tough. Those 4 weeks where my in-laws were in Gaza are probably the most difficult 4 weeks of our lives, really, if I have to, I have to say and have to confess. It's still difficult. Nadia, my wife, her brother Mohammed is still in Gaza. My wife's stepmom is still in Gaza. My wife's gran, who's 93, is still in Gaza. Aunties and uncles. And I spoke to Mohammed, spoke to him 3 days ago now. And he's in a really difficult place. I mean, he's resilient. He's strong. He's trying to just take each day as it comes. But, you know, the fact that, you know, he was finding it difficult just to get access to clean water breaks my heart. Totally breaks my heart. And the situation in Gaza is a humanitarian catastrophe beyond anything I've ever seen. And I can't understand why we still have so many political leaders refusing to call for an immediate ceasefire.
I remember reading about, you know, your situation. Just to summarise it for the listeners, your wife Nadia's parents were trapped in Gaza while visiting relatives at the time of the attack by Hamas on Israel on October the 7th. And I just remember thinking, wow, the First Minister, he can't help his family. That must have been very strange for you. You have power.
Utterly, utterly helpless. Utterly helpless. I mean, as you say, you know, by most definitions, you know, I have the most political power in Scotland, and yet I couldn't get my in-laws out of a war zone. And that's me in my position. What hope is there for so many others? And, you know, it is and feels like an utterly hopeless situation at times. And look, it's still a struggle for so many people that have family there. And that's why I'll continue to raise my voice, as people like Lord Cameron, who say that Scotland shouldn't be speaking out on foreign affairs. I think our voice is really important on the world stage. I think the more voices calling for peace, which I still can't understand how that is controversial in any way, shape or form. I think we have to keep doing that. And what we're seeing in Gaza, and the killings that we're seeing, the children that have been killed. History will judge us very poorly because of the international community's lack of response, I have to say.
How has it changed you in terms of your fire for politics? Like, there must have been a moment where you thought, oh my God, this system is not going to work to deliver the change I want to see.
Well, I think it's why we need more people and more diverse voices in politics. Because, you know, there have been so few people in the UK context that were political leaders calling for a ceasefire. And, you know, and I'm not saying this to promote myself, but I think I was probably the first in the UK to call for an immediate ceasefire. And then we had other political leaders thereafter, people like Sadiq Khan, who I respect a lot. My opposite number, you talked about Anas Sawar. A few others then began to call for a ceasefire. Now, if I hadn't been in the position that I'd been, or Sadiq hadn't been in the position he'd been, well, would there have been people calling for a ceasefire or not in the UK? I don't know is the answer to that question, but I think the more diversity in our voices and our politics is only a good thing.
Before we move off the subject, and we so appreciate, you know, obviously it's a live personal situation for you, and we so appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about this. What is your message to the UK government about its current strategy?
The UK government is a trusted ally of the government of Israel. Truthfully, I don't know how much influence they have, but the influence they should be using and exerting is precisely to ensure that one, the killing stops, but secondly, if you want to see a safe Middle East, a secure Middle East, you don't do that by killing children. That is going to have a completely counterproductive impact and effect. And I would say to the UK government, I would say to the leader of the Labour Party, not only do you risk inflaming the situation in the Middle East, what you risk if we don't stop Israel's action, which has gone beyond a legitimate response, then the ripple effects of that, including here in the UK, could be pretty significant as well. And we know that, for example, around the community tensions that exist, and they exist in Scotland, I'm sure they exist right across the UK between communities, and we just need to make sure we're doing everything we can to bring peace to that region. So I'll keep calling for an immediate ceasefire. I'll keep calling out what I see as illegitimate action. And we'll continue to call for the release of hostages, of course, because families in Israel will undoubtedly be grieving and mourning their loved ones still in captivity.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You can live out your MasterChef dream when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
This came in from at Pete W. Marshall. With the recent positive conversations being had regarding the Irish border and a possible roadmap for reunification, would successful progress from Stormont potentially move the needle on revisiting the issue of getting Scotland away from Westminster? So, I mean, obviously, what he's referring to is the massively consequential news for the UK that after 2 years of political paralysis, there's been the return of the power-sharing government in Stormont, and it's resulted in Sinn Féin having its first ever elected first minister. Were you kept in the loop about the deal that was going on with the DUP?
So I can see my special advisor's eyes popping out of his head at the question, Pete Marshall. So let me, in all truth and honesty, I wasn't kept up to date in terms of the deal. We were hearing noises that there was positive discussions going on. And I should say, look, that's our starting point. Our starting point is we really welcome the return of power sharing in Northern Ireland and the restoration of Stormont, and congratulate the First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, who I had in Bute House in Edinburgh a few months ago, and of course the Deputy First Minister, Emma Little-Pengelly, as well. So we really welcome that power sharing being restored. Look, as for a border poll in the future of Irish unification, they're not matters for me or matters for Scotland. They are matters absolutely for the people of Northern Ireland to have that discussion. And of course, the island of Ireland. There's a Good Friday Agreement there. Power sharing is a critical key part of that. But look, I wouldn't seek to interfere or influence their discussion. And I wouldn't expect that to come the other way either when it comes to the discussion on Scottish independence.
But your ears must have pricked up a bit though, right? Because, I mean, you mentioned Michelle O'Neill there, Northern Ireland's first nationalist first minister. She's from Sinn Féin. She says that a referendum on a united Ireland could come within 10 years. That would surely boost the independence cause in Scotland, no?
Yeah, but them easy, honestly. I said to you, I will answer the question, no. And in all truth, again, it will be absolutely for those in Northern Ireland to have a discussion about the future of Northern Ireland. It's not for me. In terms of independence for Scotland, look, I'm hoping that it comes sooner, way sooner than 10 years. I wish it came yesterday. In fact, so my job is to try to advance the cause of Scottish independence sooner rather than later.
A question we've had in from a listener that puts it quite succinctly. They emailed in to say, with a black hole in the Scottish budget, crisis in NHS, prison and council's funding, as well as the cost of living crisis, why are the SNP wasting government capacity on constitutional questions rather than the well-being of Scottish people? She says, thank you. And that is Fee from Stirling.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it was Asawar from Glasgow that sent in that question.
Listen, we don't know what sock puppet accounts the leader of the Scottish Labour Party is using.
Look, a few things I would say to Fee. First and foremost, the cost of living crisis, of course, is a Westminster-created cost of living crisis. It was Westminster that has imposed, what, almost 14 years of austerity. It was the Prime Minister that was outlived by a lettuce that ended up crashing and torpedoing the UK economy. It's a Brexit that none of us voted for, or the country didn't vote for, has been imposed upon us that has caused such economic damage. So actually the question of the cost of living crisis is absolutely fundamental to independence. I don't want independence because, you know, I like to wave flags or eat shortbread or paint my face with a salt tire. The reason I believe in independence is because I think it's good for our economy and our society and our people. In terms of the challenges that we face, again, I'm not going to rebut every single point. But look, Scotland is the only nation in the UK that didn't have junior doctor strikes or nurses strikes or NHS staff strikes. The reason is because we believe in paying our NHS staff fairly, and our A&E departments are the best performing compared to the rest of the UK for 8 years. The reason for that is because we value our NHS workers. And yep, does that mean we have to make tough choices? In Scotland, you may have seen, I've asked the top 5% in the country, people like me, who earn the most, to pay more in tax than perhaps the top 5% in other parts of the UK. But if we do that, then those with the great, you know, biggest shoulders pay the most. And that to me is actually good leadership, is saying, yeah, there's challenges there. Let's invest in our public services, and those who earn the most, let's make them pay that little bit more.
And I just wanted to ask you specifically about Brexit. Do you think Brexit has been a double-edged sword for the SNP? Because on the one hand, it changed the terms of membership of the United Kingdom. And certainly, I think, because Scotland did vote to remain in the European Union, it galvanised a section of Scottish society behind the idea of independence that maybe had been on the fence beforehand. But do you think some of the administrative problems with Brexit have made people cautious about changing the arrangements with your nearest trading partner? Has it helped as much as it's hurt the SNP?
I don't think so. I completely understand why you asked the question and follow your rationale around all of that. But the independent support is pretty rock solid. So the poll today that I just mentioned puts us at, what, 53% for yes. So you know, we're at 50% above, sometimes just below. So we're kind of solidly 50-50. I think the challenge for the SNP and the independence movement is we've had Boris Johnson, we've had Liz Truss, we've had Brexit. And actually, the dial on independence hasn't shifted as much as people might expect, given the disaster of those three individuals and episodes in UK politics. But that's probably because I don't think the independence movement has done enough, and we're working on this, to say to people, okay, we're not just saying you should vote, you know, you should vote against these various different factors. Here's something to vote for. So independence has to be about giving people something to vote for. I don't think we've quite done that enough. I think we've done that in parts. We've not done that enough. So we've got to galvanise, and that's why, again, I won't go into all the detail. We've published a whole series of papers in detail around, actually, if you vote for independence, here's the prize. Nobody is saying it's a land of milk and honey, but actually being able to make decisions for ourselves, ultimately based on our values, that to me is a much better future than a UK that is in absolute decline, complete and utter decline, even before Brexit, and more so since Brexit.
Do you think you might be too honest about the challenges that an independent Scotland faced? And have you considered lying on the side of a bus?
Has anybody ever tried that before? And how did it end? No, but honestly, I think it's good to, of course, be honest as much as you possibly can with people. But I think people also just wouldn't believe it. If I sat here and said to you, Nish, you know, independence is going to resolve every single problem you've ever had. We'll have, you know, there'll be no more challenges with the NHS. Our education will be the top of the international league tables. You just wouldn't believe it. And neither should you believe it. So I think we've got to be honest. But I actually say equally, there's huge opportunity, massive opportunity. And all we have to do is look at the evidence around us. Ireland, Norway, Denmark, they've all got know, better productivity. Many of them have got national incomes higher per head than the UK, lower inequality. So why on earth not Scotland, particularly with all of the resources we've got? So, no, I don't think I'm too honest. I think we should continue to be honest as much as we possibly can. And I think more politicians probably could take a leaf out of that book.
I guess the question is always, but how? Like, how would leaving the UK not put Scotland into the same position that the UK had by leaving the EU, the same weaknesses? Just for clarity, that's not from me. That's from Lewis Dunn, one of our listeners on X, formerly Twitter.
D. Ross, not Douglas Ross, leader of the Scottish Conservatives. I knew it was him. No, again, for me, I suppose the big difference is, first and foremost, we would then have unfettered access to a market that's seven times the size of the UK. It's a huge market, the world's biggest single market. And we would still continue to trade with the rest of the UK. There's no doubt about that. And of course, we do everything in our powers. And we've produced a paper on this. I won't kind of go into all the detail of it. We do everything in our powers to make sure that any light touch regulation or custom check that has to happen over the border with the rest of the UK is as light touch as possible.
Before I ask you this question, I just want you to know that this is a variation of a question we get asked every week about the Labour Party, and normally by someone from the demographic age-wise that this person comes from. It's been emailed in by Sandy Malcolm. I'm a young Scot, brackets 22, who supports independence and worries deeply about the climate crisis. I was not able to vote against Brexit or for Scottish independence due to being slightly too young. I have voted SNP wherever possible, but for the first time, I'm considering switching to the Scottish Greens. Why should I vote SNP?
Yeah, and I think a really legitimate question, a point to scrutinise the SNP on. First things to say, of course, that we're in a cooperation agreement with the Green Party, so the Green Party members are ministers in my government as well, so we work really closely with the Greens. I think the difference is, particularly in a general election, I think the Greens would be the absolute first to admit that they're not going to win a single general election seat in Scotland. They're not even close to winning a general election seat in Scotland. So if you want to make sure that we send down a message to Westminster, and if we don't send down SNP MPs to Westminster, Scotland gets ignored. So what I would say is that, look, not only are we taking incredible action on climate change, and there's always more we can do, world-leading targets, of course, and we're investing and that transition to renewable technology as part of the just transition to net zero. But if you want Scotland's voice to be heard, vote for the SNP, because in every single Conservative seat in Scotland, we are second place, so we can make Scotland Tory-free, and of course, which would be a great prize. But of course, as I say, even in those seats that we already hold, a strong contingency of SNP MPs is needed to make sure our country is not ignored.
Talking about making Scotland Tory-free suggests you know how to butter up our listenership. But I just want to talk to you about your relation with the other big political party, the United Kingdom, with the Labour Party. There are some polls that have you neck and neck with Labour in Scotland. Obviously, you've referred to the poll that gives you, I think, a 7-point lead. The eminent political analyst Sir John Curtis has predicted that you could even end up with the same number of seats. Is that something that concerns you?
Well, first of all, when you said you were going to talk to me about the other big political force in the UK, I thought you were going to talk to me about popcorn, of course. But clearly that hasn't shaken your very foundations in the same way that it has up here in Scotland.
It's the worst named thing. You could call yourselves popular conservatives all you want. If I change my name to Jay-Z, I'm not married to Beyonce. Like, that's not how anything works.
No, indeed. And being led by the least popular politician, I think, in the entire UK, who's, as I say, outlasted by a lettuce, is a level of lacking self-awareness I don't think I've ever seen. But the serious point to your question is Labour are our biggest challenge up here in Scotland. No point pretending otherwise. We've got to work hard. General elections traditionally for the SNP have been really tough. I mean, it was only post the independence referendum that we start winning big in general elections. If you go pre-2014, we had only ever had a handful of seats, 6 MPs, 5 MPs, 7 MPs. So we were never big winners in general elections. So what we've got to do is work exceptionally hard to make sure that we become the party that wins the general election. I've got every confidence, I have to say, that the SNP will win the general election whenever it's held.
You've said that you have no doubt that Keir Starmer will be the next Prime Minister, and I know you've appealed to him to have some discussions about how you can work together. Were you surprised to have your invitation rebuffed?
He doesn't write. He doesn't call.
He's left you on read.
He has. Totally, completely kind of rubber dinghy. I've not had a response. You're absolutely right. I'm pretty disappointed in Keir. Keir and I have had a couple of conversations over the last few months, mainly in passing at different events. COP28, he was there and I was there. And again, just a brief kind of 5 minute chat. And he said, you know, really want to make sure that if I'm in, then I respect evolution and, you know, you'll see a difference in approach. But he's not demonstrated that. And I've always of the belief that even though our politics might differ, there's a lot of things we can talk about, we should talk about. For me, the real tragedy of Keir Starmer is you've got somebody who's 20 to 25 points ahead in the polls. And his main tactic is to try to create a manifesto that, in Labour's words, is Tory bomb-proof. So it's effectively just aligning. So at a time when you should be bold, you should be radical because you've got such a strong lead in the polls, you're coming in and presenting just complete banality. And, you know, if I give you an example where I think we could work together, the two-child limit in terms of the benefits.
Mm. Yeah.
Here is a policy that is keeping 250,000 children across the UK in poverty. Anti-poverty charities tell you just that one measure, lifting that one measure lifts 250,000 children, including quite significant numbers in Scotland, I think around 15,000 in Scotland, out of poverty, almost at the drop of a hat. And yet he is refusing to commit to do that. And it's, for me, not just tragic, but unforgivable. So what I'm saying to Keir Starmer is, look, come and have a chat. We'll support you with the MPs we've got. We'll support you around the Green Prosperity Fund, because not only is that the right thing to do by the climate, it's a huge economic opportunity for Scotland. I know the real reason why both of you didn't come to Scotland is because it's quite windy, but that wind is good for us up here in terms of our offshore wind capacity. So huge economic opportunity. But we're not seeing anything from Keir Starmer that demonstrates a man who's willing to demonstrate leadership or show leadership, just wants to get the keys to number 10, and goodness knows what he'll do when he's there.
And how about with Rishi Sunak then? Are you getting on?
Again, that's Buttamizi after Buttamizi after Buttamizi to try to push me into a very difficult response. There's no personal relationship there, I have to say. I remember my first conversation with Rishi Sunak.
So he's ghosting you too, just for clarity.
Yeah, no. In fairness to Rishi Sunak, we've had a number of meetings and conversations. But I do remember the first one that we had. It was a telephone call. I'd just become First Minister. And, you know, I thought just the way to kind of break the ice, you know, I'd speak about the common heritage we've got and the background that we've got. And look, you know, obviously there's disagreements, Prime Minister, between us, but, you know, I think it's an important moment that you became the Prime Minister as a person of colour. And there was just no, I was like, okay, let's talk about, you know, business and talk about the deposit return scheme. And so I felt, right, we're not going to be having a nice, cosy chat to begin with. And it's clear, the second thing that was very clear from that first phone call was how quickly he wanted off the phone.
Right.
I did have a list of about six different things that I'm going to raise these issues with you that we need to talk about as well. But, you know, he just wanted off the call. So, no, there's genuinely no, I'm afraid there's no personal relationship there, which is not really a big issue. But, professionally, I think the less he can see of me, he probably feels the better.
Nothing's going to be helped by the First Minister and the Prime Minister not getting on, right? That's going to be bad in any iteration, whether in independent Scotland or not. So it is quite crucial.
To an extent, I mean, you don't have to be best pals. I think if you're just able to show a bit of humanity. I'll give you an example, and this is in fairness to Keir Starmer. You know, when we were going through what was a really difficult time that you've already touched upon with my in-laws being in Gaza, you know, Keir Starmer, in fairness to him, reached out and picked up the phone and said, politics aside, really thinking about you and your family, my thoughts are with you and the thoughts of the Labour Party are with you, and you know, phoned me personally to say that, not just put out a statement. And I thought, that's a decent mark of an individual. Whereas, you know, nothing from the Prime Minister, and actually at the time the Foreign Secretary had to be shamed into talking to me. I think a number of media interviews where I was asked if James Cleverly had been in touch, and I said he's not, and he was ultimately shamed into picking up the phone to me. So I think, look, at the basic kind of common humanity doesn't cost us anything.
The only vague positive I can take from that is I previously did not believe James Cleverly had the capacity for shame. So actually, that's it's not a bad thing to hear. We have a very engaged and well-read and well-informed listenership, but some of them have also asked some more relaxed questions of you. If you weren't in politics, what job would you have? That's from Clara McCabe, and I would tag on to that question. I assume it's got to be something to do with Celtic Football Club.
Yes, I mean, other than being chairman of Celtic Football Club, which would, of course, be what I would be doing if I wasn't in politics. You know, this is in South Asians too, right? When I was growing up, you were either to be a doctor, dentist, pharmacist, accountant, or lawyer.
Yeah.
Bus, right? It was one of those. And I always thought I'd end up being a lawyer. And in fact, I put it down in my, what we call the UCAS form, the university entrance form here. I put down law and all of the options except the last one, I snuck in politics. And I got into both law and politics. And I remember it was the scariest conversation I had to have with my parents, my South Asian lovely DC parents, to tell them, by the way, I'm not going to do law, I want to do politics. And I kind of braced myself for the inevitable slipper that was coming. But it didn't come, and parents were exceptionally positive. So, long answer to the short question is probably would have been something to do with law, I would have thought.
First Minister, cry me a fucking river. I have to have a conversation about being a stand-up comedian.
And that's why they still don't talk to you to this day.
Okay. So what are some other jobs you've had outside of politics? The worse, the better, please.
Oh, right. Mainly call centre jobs. But I also worked, my very first job was working in the sixth floor of a dusty clothes cash and carry. I think getting paid £2.05 an hour. But you had this lift, so it was a sixth floor. You had a lift where you had to take the boxes of socks and pants and all these things up to the sixth floor. And it was not a lift, not an electric lift. You had to wind it up by hand. And because I did this for about
You're
3 months...
You're not that old, mate. What is this story from 1974?
I was actually 13 and it was like the summer of the holidays. So like 2 months, I think it was, of doing this. I had the right bicep, it's like Popeye, and I had the left arm, which was like a string bean. So I came out with this huge bicep in my right hand, having wound up this lift for the best part of 8 weeks, and nothing on the left hand, which was...
Everyone's like, why is Hamza always sideways on now?
I will say this. There's probably different reasons people think a 13-year-old boy has a stronger hand than one arm.
There's always one in the gutter. There's always one in the teacher.
Well, look, the final word does go to our listener, Kirat Randhawa, who writes on Instagram, no questions, but please let him know he's gorgeous. How does that feel?
That's my mum's sock puppet account. Thanks, Mum. That's very kind.
Listen, First Minister, thank you so much for your time. We very much appreciate it. We do want to save the UK, but you're always welcome.
Thank you very much. That's really good chatting to you. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much, First Minister Hamza Yousaf.
Thank you.
You might have heard that former US President Trump was ordered to pay $83.3 million in damages after a huge defeat in his most recent defamation trial.
On Crooked's legal pod, Strict Scrutiny, hosts Kate Shaw, Leah Lippman and Melissa Murray speak to the woman awarded. That's E. Jean Carroll and her lawyer, Roberta Kaplan, on a special bonus episode.
You can listen to this episode out now on the Strict Scrutiny feed.
You can get in touch with us by emailing psuk@reducelistening.co.uk. It's always lovely to hear your voices, so just send us a voice note. On WhatsApp, our number is 07514 644 572. And internationally, that's +44 7514 644 572.
Don't forget to follow @PodSaveTheUK on Instagram and Twitter. You can also find us on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you like, you can drop us a review too. Be nice though, we're very sensitive.
We have feelings.
Pod Save the UK is a reduced listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to senior producer Musty Aziz and digital producer Alex Bishop.
Video editing was by Nada Smiljanic and the music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
Thanks to our engineer, David Degahi.
The executive producers are Anishka Sharma, Dan Jackson and Madeline Herringer, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
And remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify, Apple or wherever you get your podcasts.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.